From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, events, and issues that matter to you. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, we're going to have a conversation with Dr. Michael Mann, a well-known climatologist who helped pioneer methods to track global temperatures and the climate across centuries, among many other accomplishments. We'll talk about climate change denial, climate conflicts, and the potential for America to lead in finding a solution.
China and India can point to us and say, look, you had two centuries of relatively free access to cheap fossil fuel energy, and it's how you built up your economies. Don't we have the right to that ourselves? And who are we to tell them no if we don't have our own house in order, if we are not making earnest efforts to reduce our carbon emissions?
And your local headlines next on The Rundown. And welcome back to The Rundown this afternoon. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up later on the show, we'll have a conversation with climatologist Dr. Michael Mann. But first up, we have these headlines. A Utah man accused of trying to persuade people to give him more than $1 million for phony oil investments in Nigeria has been indicted on federal fraud charges. Brandon Benson was charged with 4 counts of wire fraud in the grand jury indictment handed up Wednesday in U.S. District Court in Salt Lake City. Prosecutors say Benson lived in Salt Lake City and Orange County, California, where he solicited nearly $1.5 million from 7 investors from 2007 to 2010. Benson allegedly told his victims that shipments of oil would be purchased at locations in Africa and transported and sold at higher prices in other parts of that continent. He's accused of carrying out a Ponzi scheme by using money obtained from new investors to pay money owed to earlier investors. A new study by University of Utah researchers reveals that mice with conditions similar to multiple sclerosis are able to walk just a couple of weeks after being treated with human stem cells. KCPW's Ryan Cunningham has more.
4 years ago, scientists at the University of Utah injected human stem cells into mice with symptoms comparable to multiple sclerosis. And frankly, they didn't expect much. The researchers thought the human cells would be rejected by the mice bodies. But something else happened.
Then I was in my office and my postdoctoral fellow, Lu Chen, came in and said, you know, Tom, the mice are walking. And I didn't believe her. And I said, well, I have to see this for myself. So I went down and sure enough, the animals that had received the cells had clearly regained motor skills. And this was sustained out to about 6 months post-transplant.
That's Dr. Tom Lane, a pathologist who co-authored the study released Thursday in the journal Stem Cell Reports. And you heard him right. In less than 2 weeks, transplanting human stem cells had almost completely reversed the symptoms. Why? Lane says the transplanted cells created a chemical reaction that protected, then repaired, the central nervous system of the mice. Lane calls that reparative element a unique result among similar studies. It might seem intuitive given the results of the study, but transplanting human stem cells into humans may not be the end result of this research.
If we can identify what factors are being secreted by these cells, perhaps we don't have to do the stem cell transplant. We could just make a druggable target and either administer this by injection or, you know, the gold standard is to make an oral drug.
Lane says the next step is to test the research on other animal models, as well as trying to figure out what specific proteins the stem cells are secreting to trigger the reparative reaction. For KCPW News, I'm Ryan Cunningham.
On Wednesday night, KCPW, the Salt Lake Tribune, and the University of Utah's Hinckley Institute of Politics hosted a debate on public lands management in Utah. I attended the event last night and filed this report. The event took the form of an Oxford-style debate, meaning that there were two sides, each speaking in favor of or in opposition to a simple statement. The exact motion in question was, "The state of Utah is best suited to manage public lands within its borders." Hundreds of people crowded into the auditorium of Salt Lake's main library to hear Republican State Representative and American Lands Council head Ken Ivory and Utah House Speaker Rebecca Lockhart speaking in favor of the statement, and former Bureau of Land Management Director Pat Shea and University of Utah Environmental and Sustainability Studies Program Director Dan McCool speaking in opposition. The gist of the arguments was as you might expect. Here's Ivory saying that Utah should be given title to public lands, as happened with many eastern states throughout American history.
It was in 1896 that Utah was made a state with the same statehood terms to transfer the public lands as North Dakota and all the states east of Colorado. The promises are the same. By 1915, the Utah legislature demanded the president and the Congress for a speedy return to the policy of transferring title to the public lands.
And here's McCool making the case for continued federal control, quoting a section of the U.S. Constitution giving authority to Congress to make rules governing land policy.
The Congress shall have the power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations, that's all needful rules and regulations, respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States.
Serving as a backdrop to the debate were some recent flashpoints over public lands, a weekend protest ATV ride on an off-limits BLM trail, and the armed standoff between Nevada rancher Cliven Bundy and his supporters and the BLM over unpaid cattle grazing fees. In addition, recent years have seen the state legislature pass bills demanding that the federal government cede control of certain public lands to the state. Here's former BLM director Pat Shea addressing some of the tensions surrounding the issue.
What happened in Nevada, what happened in San Juan County, is inherently dangerous to BLM employees, to federal employees, to state employees. The idea that a 5 or 7 year old can be riding on the handlebars of an ATV with an automatic weapon held by the driver is absolutely, in anybody's sense, unsafe. If that's the kind of way that we're going to have the states managing public lands, then heaven help us.
At the beginning of the debate, the Salt Lake Tribune's Jennifer Napier Pierce took the pulse of the audience, both those in attendance and those who were listening in on the radio and online, through a text message poll. That poll showed a 59-41 split, with the majority opposing Utah management of public lands. At the end of the debate, the needle moved a little. A final tally showed a 54-46% vote, still in favor of Shea and McCool and continued federal management. Among those in attendance was Garfield County Commissioner Del Lefevre, who said that the debate wasn't ever going to change his mind, and that he had come to show support for Representatives Ken Ivory and Becky Lockhart. Lefevre said that an abundance of natural resources meant that the state could afford to pay for the management of its public lands.
We got natural resources to bail this state out and the federal government. Down in Garfield County, that Caparis coal is the largest known coal reserve in America, or probably United, in the world. And yet they buttoned it up in a monument, so nothing can happen.
Retired university professor Bob Finley also went in and came out of the debate with more or less the same opinion.
I probably would support the federal government maintaining the federal lands. I own some land next to the Dixie National Forest and next to BLM. And for years, a local rancher has grazed his cows on my land.
Generally, the panelists were civil toward each other, though each side on occasion received some ribbing from a divided audience. A full version of Wednesday night's debate can be found at kcpw.org. A new report from the University of Utah estimates this year's Sundance Film Festival generated an overall economic impact of $86 million to the state, providing $6.9 million in tax revenue. The study says 45,000 people who attended the festival spent nearly $64 million. That's about $7 million more than in 2013. Attendance has remained about the same for the past 4 years. The economic impact was the highest since 2009, attributed in part to researchers counting 6 extra months of spending by the Sundance Institute. The festival was held January 16th through 24th at 4 Utah locations, marking the 30th year of an event that brings Hollywood stars and international attention to Utah. In November, Utah Governor Gary Herbert honored Sundance founder Robert Redford for his cultural and economic contributions to Utah. And that does it for our summary of the day's top local headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Now on the show, we'll turn to a conversation with Dr. Michael Mann, a well-known climatologist who helped pioneer methods to track the climate and global temperatures through the centuries. This allowed scientists to show a marked increase in temperatures stemming from an enormous increase in global carbon emissions in the wake of the Industrial Revolution. Dr. Mann, who currently leads Penn State University's Earth System Science Center, was in Salt Lake this week at the behest of the local environmental nonprofit Heal Utah. Michael Mann, thank you very much for joining us today on the program.
Thanks. It's great to be here with you.
this is something we have to get out of the way at the beginning of the interview. There are people out there who still deny climate change, but the overwhelming evidence is that, look, it's happening, it's here, it's now.
Yeah, I mean, there's no logical argument for denying that it's happening. And it isn't just me. It isn't just, you know, individual climate scientists who are telling us that. It's the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, the highest scientific authority in the land, based on the evidence. It's not just that they're going along with the crowd. Based on the evidence, they have concluded that climate change is real, it's caused by us, and it represents a threat if we don't do something about it. National academies of all the major industrial nations are on record with the same conclusion. Every scientific society in the U.S. that deals in any of the underlying science, you know, the American Chemical Society, American Physical Society, the world scientists have stated very clearly, you know, this is real. There's just no way to deny that. And it's caused by us, and it will be a problem if we don't do something about it.
You wrote an op-ed in the New York Times in January, and it's called If You See Something, Say Something. The debate you stress in this op-ed shouldn't be over whether or not climate change, you know, exists, because that argument is done, but what we should do about it and how we should address this problem. Are there competing ideas about how we address this problem?
Well, there are, and I think that's, you know, that's a worthy debate to have, how we go about solving this problem. And one of the things that is encouraging to me is the fact that there's a growing number of voices from conservatives, the conservative community, coming out and saying, you know, let's be at the table here. We can't continue to deny that this problem exists. We have to accept the facts. But let's have that discussion about how we go about dealing with the problem. And there's an opportunity for conservatives to bring ideas to the table that are consistent with a conservative ideology. One of the vehicles that's talked about quite a bit these days is the revenue neutral carbon tax.
Right.
So we could put a tax on carbon, but we could lower other taxes in such a way that there's no net increase in taxation of the American people, just a redistribution that focuses the taxes in a way that helps solve this problem, helps put a price on the emission of carbon. And I think that's a worthy idea, and we should be talking about things like that.
And that's essentially alleviating other taxes to allow this carbon tax to happen.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, maybe we could get a sense of where we are right now in terms of the research on climate change. I know we had the National Climate Assessment that came out just a couple of days ago. There was recent data from NASA, from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. What's the current latest news on this issue?
Well, we just had an article come out, or actually two articles that came out simultaneously the other day, and it's got they've both gotten some media attention. What these articles have shown is that we have likely now committed to the melting of a substantial part of the West Antarctic ice sheet, enough of that ice sheet to contribute 10 feet of global sea level rise. That's 10 feet more in the pipeline than we didn't think was already in the pipeline. So that's on top of the sea level rise that we were already fairly certain we would see because of the melting of other glaciers, because of the expansion of the oceans, the thermal expansion of the oceans with warming. So this is an example of a potential tipping point. It's something where we crossed a threshold in the amount of warming that we've already put into the system, and we can't undo it.
Right.
Once you cross that threshold, it's going to happen. Now, there's some question as to how long it will take to play out. Will it play out over 2 centuries? If so, that could be catastrophic. Or will we luck out, and will it play out over 9 centuries? Well, we don't know the answer, but it's an example of how uncertainty doesn't necessarily work in our favor, because there is a possibility that the changes could be larger than our models currently say they're likely to be. And that's one of the lessons that we learn as we continue to study the climate system. We find that in many cases, the changes are unfolding faster than we originally thought they would.
You know, I wish I'd studied science more, but I do remember that as the ice sheets melt, the reflective quality, as far as the amount of energy that's being bounced off back into space from the sun, lessens because the water is there and that's absorbing the energy and that creates its own problem. I mean, is there a point at which that becomes this sort of self-replicating cycle?
Yeah, it's what we refer to as a positive feedback. But that can be a misleading term because it almost sounds good. It's
right.
Like, your boss, congratulated you, gave you positive feedback on that task you just completed. in this case, it's not a good thing. What it means, it's a vicious cycle. It's an amplifying factor. And so when you melt away ice, the Earth absorbs more of the incoming sunlight, so the Earth warms even more. It amplifies the warming beyond what we would have seen had that not happened. It's just one of many of these so-called feedback mechanisms. Another, in fact, even more important feedback mechanism is as we warm the Earth and we warm the oceans and the atmosphere can hold more moisture. Well, moisture, water vapor, is a potent greenhouse gas itself. And that means that the greenhouse effect gets even greater. And that's another very important amplifying factor. And it's the reason why climate models predict quite a bit more warming than we would expect just from the CO2 alone that we're putting into the atmosphere. It isn't just the CO2 we're putting into the atmosphere. It's the way the climate system responds to that increased CO2, whether it's the melting of ice, the increased amount of moisture in the atmosphere. So these so-called feedback mechanisms take what otherwise would be a mild problem and turn it into a major one.
Okay, we talked about how the debate needs to be over how we actually address this problem. And there are people who talk about focusing our attention on adaptation, on getting ready for the coming future, which I guess we have to do no matter what at this point. But there are also questions on the strategies involved, on investing in new sources of clean energy and getting rid of our reliance on fossil fuels here in the United States. But a question that often gets asked and that I'd ask you to address is, what about emerging economies around the globe? You know, we've seen this increase in greenhouse gases since the Industrial Revolution, but there are some countries out there that are just sort of coming online when it comes to carbon emissions, and they're poised to ramp up those emissions. A defeatist might say, why are we trying to do anything when there's that looming background?
It's a great question. I mean, you know, much of the increase in greenhouse gas concentrations that's occurred thus far is due to, you know, the industrial world. It's due to the U.S. and Europe, Australia. Much of the increase we're likely to see in the next century isn't going to come from us. It's going to come from other countries, developing countries that are now coming online with their energy economy. And so it's critical that any effort to reduce greenhouse gas emissions have on board countries like China and India. Now, the role that we play is to display some moral leadership, some moral authority here. After all, you know, China and India can point to us and say, look, you had two centuries of relatively free access to cheap fossil fuel energy, and it's how you built up your economies. Don't we have the right to that ourselves? And who are we to tell them no if we don't have our own house in order, if we are not making earnest efforts to reduce our carbon emissions? And so clearly, any viable treaty to reduce carbon emissions is going to have to involve as actors both the traditional industrial countries like the U.S. and the developing world, China, India, South America.
Can I ask, there's kind of a waiting game that's been going on, and sometimes people expect technology to solve the problem in that, you know, if we just had cold fusion, then everything would be great. But, I mean, what are your thoughts on pursuing, on two things? One is pursuing, you know, that silver bullet or whatever it is, or pursuing new forms of energy. And then the other side of that, which is that that gives some people this idea that, oh, if we just wait long enough, there will be this right. technological fix.
Right. I mean, there is, you know, a widespread sentiment, you know, you often encounter that, well, you know, technology can solve this problem. We'll grow out of this problem. And yet, you know, we've seen some examples of how that isn't necessarily true. When the Deep Horizon's oil leak in the Gulf of Mexico occurred, it took months for us to finally plug that hole. And there was quite a bit of uncertainty as to whether or not we were going to even be able to do it. It turns out it's much easier to create a problem than to solve one. And that's the danger here, that we are creating a problem that technology alone will not be able to solve. And, you know, maybe we get lucky and we have, you know, we find that technological silver bullet. But guess what? It's a lot more likely that that won't happen. And what we're gambling with is the one Earth that we have. It's the one planet that can sustain life. And if we destroy this planet, there's no planet B to go off to.
Within the amount of travel, probably.
Within light years.
You in the op-ed you wrote in the New York Times, you talked about what scientists should do. And I wanted to talk about the role of scientists in the climate discussion. And you mentioned James Hansen, former director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, who has turned in his part to civil disobedience. I mean, he's getting arrested. He's saying, look, this demands action. Nobody's paying attention. I'm going to do what I have to do by creating a cause. That's one route. Other routes are talking on the radio. Other routes are getting involved in public debate. But I feel like sometimes there's a bit of a climate shtick. People have the conversation and that's it. The conversation's done.
Right.
There's comedy to it. I can't remember his name.
John Oliver had an amazing piece the other night. Yeah,
with Bill Nye the Science Guy.
Yeah.
And I think they're effective and they're great and they show that this debate is done. But then people go home and, you know, the world continues as it goes. What is to be done?
Yeah, so it's not enough to just say, hey, there's a problem and we need to do something about it. If that's all there is, if that's the message, it's easy to understand how people disengage because they don't see the solution. They don't see what they can do. They don't see something actionable that they can do. And so it's equally important to convey that, hey, we can actually solve this problem. And you know what? If we engage in that solution, if we embrace that challenge, it's going to grow the economy. It's going to lead to new industries. It's going to help us compete in, you know, the next century where, you know, the rest of the world, China, India, they recognize that the future of the global economy is going to be in a clean energy economy. And they're investing a whole lot more now in renewable energy than we are. We are falling behind in terms of our competitiveness, falling behind countries like China and India. You know, that's never been the way the U.S. went about things. We've always been leaders. And there's the danger here that we lose our status as a leader.
And aside from that, there are those who say that this is a moral imperative, that there is reason for action the way that there may have been reason for action for war in certain instances in the past, right, or what have you.
Yeah, and this is a point, of course, that I also made in my op-ed, that what we're talking about here, you know, it's us, because there are a lot of ways in which climate change is already impacting us negatively in our lives now. But more than that, it's about, you know, what sort of world do we want to leave behind for our children and grandchildren? Do we want our legacy to be a fundamentally degraded planet? And I think the answer to that is no. I don't think that's what any of us want.
Right. Well, you would hope not. But the drive for immediate gain and immediate return on investment maybe can get in the way. Dr. Mann, we only have a short time left before you have to get to another appointment. But I wanted to ask you about something. It's not really your field of expertise, but there have been some reports on security. A decade ago, the Pentagon released a report saying that this is an issue of national security importance, maybe the issue of national security importance. A couple of days ago, there was a report from another security group saying it is causing conflict now.
Yeah.
That's another consideration, right?
It is. I mean, you know, we often frame this problem in terms of, you know, polar bears in the Arctic. But you know what? It's a lot more than a threat to animal species way up in some exotic location that we never get to. It's about how climate change is impacting us now with regard to food and water and human health and, yes, national security. And this isn't me. This isn't a bunch of scientists telling us it. This is our leaders. This is our national security leaders coming forward and saying, look, one of the greatest threats to national security in the decades ahead is going to be climate change, because what we're talking about is increased competition for diminishing food, diminishing water, and diminishing land among a growing global population, and that's a perfect recipe for conflict. So the costs in terms of you know, national security already. We are, you know, fighting wars in dangerous places because of our addiction, our reliance on fossil fuels. And climate change is going to make these challenges even worse.
In terms of drought, in terms of closer to home here, an increase in wildfires, even fights with neighboring states over water, et cetera.
Absolutely.
Michael Mann, I wish I had you for longer here, but I want to thank you for coming in. Michael Mann is the director of the Earth Systems Science Center at Pennsylvania State University and the author of The Hockey Stick and The Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. Check out that book if you can. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And you can find this interview, along with all of our past shows, at our website, kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for tuning into The Rundown this afternoon. We'll be right back. And thanks again for tuning into The Rundown this evening. Our show was produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Ryan Cunningham, Jesse Ellis, and Mr. Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tune in each weekday at 5 for an exploration of local news, events, and issues that matter to you on The Rundown. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter. Our handle is at @KCPWRundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for the Utah Business Report and Marketplace.